Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, I really enjoyed yesterday's episode on game theory, and you're telling me there's a second part today?
That's right, Jim. Here it is tomorrow.
Okay, Patrick, I want to get right back into this special two-part series, I guess, yep. On game theory yep. that you have been working on for a long time. So
really long, yeah.
That's okay. That's, you know, sometimes it takes time to, you know, get it where we want it to be, right? So the show you're listening to, especially if you're new and you came because you want to hear this game theory stuff, the show is called Rockin' the Suburbs, and we talk about music from the suburbs of Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And my name is Jim Lenihan.
And I am Patrick Foster.
And we are currently in separate basements, but soon
that's
we think
right.
to start recording in person again together. So, all right. So tell people again, you know, what this project is.
Basically, me combining some interviews I did about a year ago with two people very familiar with the work of game theory and Scott Miller, the leader, and also sort of weaving in just basically a little bit of their history, you know, when they played, what records they put out, what their influence was, and some of the things they did. And just trying to give everybody who may not know this really excellent American band, you know, a little sense of what they were about, and hopefully get them into them if they hadn't heard it, mainly because it really strikes a lot of chords with, you know, all the music that we love. I mean, Alex Chilton, Brian Wilson, John Lennon, Paul McCartney were kind of Scott Miller's big heroes. And also he was right there and played a lot with bands like R.E.M. and Let's Active and the DBs mm-hmm. and all those groups that we all like so much and hold dear from the 80s and early 90s. And you're also going to hear Annie, especially in this one, talk about some really interesting things about the influence of game theory and some of the bands they sort of really helped shape. And I'll say two things. One, we thought this was an ideal time because we had a wonderful chat with Bill Davis from Dash Rip Rock on Monday. And the second thing is, unfortunately, Scott Miller's life ended way too early, kind of tragically, and you'll hear a little bit about that at the end, but we're not going to dwell on it. But the anniversary of his passing, he passed on April 15th, 2013. So it's April 21st as you hear this. So it's fairly close to the time that he passed on, you know, going on, getting close to a decade now, 8 years ago. So another time to sort of, you know, it seemed right to kind of put this together. And on a happier note, all of Game Theory's records have been reissued by Omnivore Recordings now. So everything's out there in print and fresh, and people can go out and find it.
Very cool. All right. Let's move on to part two, right?
Let's do it. The hot, humid summer of 1986, and a much younger Patrick Foster had a broken heart. Yes, his heart was broken. He thought he was in love, but a few years later, he'd realize he never really had been in love. He's also working in a mall record store, Sam Goody, in suburban Maryland, and one of his regular jobs, is to put away the new product that comes in. I believe it was on a Tuesday. One day in the late part of that summer, A cassette came in on a label called Enigma Records. It was being distributed by Capitol at that time. So the reach for Enigma suddenly was much, much larger than it would have ever been before. A record store like Sam Goody would never have gotten a cassette on an indie label out of Los Angeles, California, like Enigma. And the young Patrick spotted a cassette tape by a band called Game Theory. The record was called The Big Shot Chronicles. He got it. He played it. And inside of this record was kind of a salve for a broken heart. It was angry, and yet it felt desperate. It was literate, and yet it felt like rock and roll. It was filled with really cool guitar sounds and really cool drum sounds and really cool little touches from keyboards. Not an instrument Patrick was particularly open to at the time, but it all seemed to work. There were these male-female vocals that were really incredible. And after some close study, Patrick saw that the record was produced by Mitch Easter, the same guy who had produced records by his beloved REM in Drive-In Studio in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. This was a revelation. The music was sprightly and incredible. The singer had a very unique voice. It almost felt paper thin at times, like it was going to break. Yet he would sneer these lines out that really made someone with a broken heart feel like they could get back at that person who did it to them, and in a smart way, you know, in a clever way. And it felt like you were rising above something, like you were growing, like you were becoming something else. And this was my introduction to Game Theory, folks. It was the Big Shot Chronicles, and I loved it from top to bottom. My favorite song, probably Crash Into June. About this time the girls are rising early. I'm gonna find a way to get back someday. Leaving rooms, I don't know why someone would leave. Though it's taken time till I discover, don't you put your hand in any other. They suggest piano. I loved all the songs. I loved Here It Is Tomorrow, the opening track, Where You're Going Northern, which is a beautiful ballad. I've Tried Subtlety really got to me. Erica's Word. There was a song about Christmas called Regenis Rain. You know, there was happy, sad, slow, fast. There was kind of everything that a burgeoning music lover would really come to find fascinating. And this was where I got into Scott Miller and Game Theory, and I was lucky. I wasn't lucky that my heart was broken, but I was lucky that it was in a place to be receptive to this beautiful music that was nuanced and subtle and different. And I think one of the things that really, really struck me about this record was these incredible male-female harmony vocals that were happening. And throughout Scott Miller's career, he always had a female voice in the band, and he loved to blend that. And let's hear from our expert, Annie Zaleski, about the importance of Scott Miller and a female voice and the way he used that in his band Game Theory.
Like many songwriters and, you know, many power pop fans, but Scott was also a big Beatles fan. So he wrote a lot of songs with women or, you know, in the title. You know, one of their famous songs is Erica's Word, and The Real Sheila. But, you know, having a woman in the band, but he was also, his music was so sensitive and so smart and kind of complex, and adding kind of the female vocal tone, which was so different. And Scott too, I should say as well, also has a really interesting voice. You know, it's a very unique, you know, it's really hard to kind of put into words what his voice sounds like, because it's also very delicate. But having a woman kind of being a foil for that just really kind of fit his voice. It was kind of like yin and yang. Like, they just really were kind of, women singing kind of brought out different elements of his voice. Scott really played off of the feminine energy of the singers that have, And, you know, you're right. He, in some cases, he was in a relationship with them. So there was also that kind of that, you know, personal connection and that personal tension. But he really fed off of the energy of the singers, you know, because obviously when, you know, the female vocal tone is a little bit different and slightly different than, you know, and you would kind of, you know, he would have to kind of mold his voice in a slightly different way than if he was, you know, harmonizing or singing with a man.
Winter houses turning on the glow. Christmas based on Christmas long ago. Could I have known where this would lead? Something that I never thought I'd need. Reaching this region, this region is right. Reaching this region,
The Big Shot Chronicles was recorded in October of 85 during a pause in the tour to support the previous album, Real Nighttime. It was released in 1986. Producer Mitch Easter would later say that the recording was the most effortless studio experience he'd ever had. The chemistry between Miller and Easter, plus the tightness the band had achieved while touring, combined to take the record leaps and bounds beyond what they'd previously achieved. The Miller-Easter combination had now fully clicked, and Scott told an interviewer around this time that, quote, "Mitch and I are real historians. We're both really into 70s rock. The song I've tried, Subtlety, I said to him, I want a drum sound just like Low by David Bowie. So we kind of went for that." Once again, reviews for the record were positive and became the biggest seller so far, though those figures are relatively modest. And by the fall of 86, when college students were headed back to campus and a tour to support the album had been booked, Miller had changed the lineup once again. Donette Thayer, Miller's girlfriend at the time, joined as rhythm guitarist and vocalist, and Guillaume Gasson replaced Susie Ziegler on bass. This lineup would hold together long enough to complete the tour and record the band's next record, The Sprawling Lolita Nation. And it was that album that really impressed Brett Milano, author of Don't All Think Me at Once, The Lost Pop Genius of Scott Miller.
I'm at a radio show, a college radio show that a friend of mine is doing. And she just puts on a random track, which was Here It Is Tomorrow, the first song on the album Big Shot Chronicles. And that just knocked me sideways. I mean, that the masterful way he deploys the hook in that song. And, you know, as you know, the song, it's over in about 2 minutes and 15 seconds. And you're kind of left going, wow, you know, that's amazing. Play that again. And that got me into his orbit. I got that album, thought it was really good. I thought Erica's Word was a terrific song. But what really sealed the deal for me was Lolita Nation, which came out the following year. And to my mind, you know, I thought and still think it was so far beyond what he'd done before and so far beyond what a lot of people were doing at the time, that I was absolutely on the train from then on.
released on December 1st, 1987, anyone unwrapping the album as a holiday gift that season would have been slightly perplexed. It's a magnificent double album that seemed to collect every musical thought that had ever passed through Miller's brain. Music writer Mark Deming's review of the record captures the sonic swirl nicely. Quote, certainly Game Theory's most ambitious album, Lolita Nation, was a 2-LP set that combined some of Miller's most user-friendly power pop squared off against dark, moody ruminations on betrayal, failed love, and mortality. All of it punctuated with bursts of avant-garde noise and unclassifiable studio doodling, and finally thrown into a sonic Cuisinart through Miller's aggressive use of oral montage. Game Theory's most challenging work, Lolita Nation, is a bit disorienting on first listen, though it finds the band playing at the very top of its form on demanding material. The record does indeed grow with repeated listens, and through that so-called winter of 88, it proved to be four sides full of pure fascination. And that broken heart of Patrick's? Well, there was something utterly amazing for him about a record that contained a song called The Real Sheila. Heartbroken? How about Heart Mended? Lolita Nation's shorter tracks reveal the influence of bands like the Minutemen, while the longer, more melodic tunes contain plenty of hints of Miller's 60s and 70s touchstones. But as Brett Milano points out, it was much more meticulously planned than it might seem, and that was down to Miller's extraordinary intelligence.
The way his mind worked is pretty hard to get into, because he was pretty far advanced. When he was commuting to work every day, he'd just write a lot of the songs on the train on the way to and from his day job. In terms of the way he did his music, he always had a clear picture in his head. He knew where everything was going to go. And yet his idea of what music was, I mean, was, you know, as you say, it was very emotional. It wasn't math rock. It was stuff that's going to hit you on that kind of deeper level. And he just somehow organized all that in his head. And it's not something a lot of, I do believe he was a genius.
The record is best absorbed as a whole, where the melodic peaks and valleys nestle in their natural habitat among the shorter fragments. But simply put, some of the best songs of Miller's career are here. We Love You, Carolyn Allison, Chardonnay, The Waist and the Knees, Together Now Very Minor, The Last Day That We're Young, and the aforementioned The Real Sheila. Lolita Nation is not the place to start with Game Theory, but it is the summit, your reward, that you will reach after climbing through the gorgeous foothills of Big Shot Chronicles and Real Nighttime.
Came.
five-piece lineup that made Lolita Nation held together for a supporting tour, and they became the only lineup to record consecutive Game Theory albums. Mitch Easter was again in the producers, but Miller wanted to take a sharp turn from the sprawl of Lolita Nation, envisioning an album of more direct, almost single-like songs. The result was to be the final album released while the band was still together, and its title conveyed history and the lengthening shadow of life. Two steps from the Middle Ages. And another kind of shadow was starting to cover the band. The fact that despite one excellent and two brilliant albums, the band were barely closer to success than they had been when they started. Not even able to afford a touring vehicle that would allow them to lay down and sleep. Add to that the fact that bands they considered inferior to them were getting played on the radio and headlining bigger venues. There was a sense of frustration. As Brett Milano observes in his book, it was hardly a shock then that Two Steps from Middle Ages came across like a commercially designed album, with slightly slicker production, more obvious hooks, and none of Lolita's sonic experimentation. And as we wrap up the story here of Game Theory with her last album, I want to jump back into Patrick mode and say, Two Steps from Middle Ages is not a bad album at all. You know, I think if I was putting together how I feel about the Game Theory albums, I mean, I think it's right there kind of on a parallel line with Real Nighttime. Now, in a different sense, Real Nighttime is an album that came on the ascendancy of Game Theory, and Two Steps is kind of on the way down. And you know, kind of as I said, I think Lolita Nation is kind of that peak, and I put, you know, for me personally, I put the Big Shot Chronicles right up there just because of what it means to me and the way I love the songs and how it was my first Game Theory album. But Two Steps is not a bad album at all. It's very, very, very good. I mean, there are songs like Room for One More Honey, What the World Wants, Amelia, You Have Lost. And especially, I think, take a listen to this song, Throwing the Election. Check out kind of the tone, the anger there, the frustration almost that underpins it. And especially, check out the line, I have the feeling it's all rigged. So looking back on this brilliant band and the brilliant records they put out and the brilliant songwriting and incredible production and intelligence of Scott Miller, it begs the question, why didn't they have broader success? Why weren't they better known? And how did all this affect Scott? Here's Brett Milano again.
Yeah, I think it hurt him quite a bit because I think despite the self-deprecating thing, I think he knew how good he was. And I think it's one of those questions that can't be answered. It's like why Game Theory did not have a college radio hit. I mean, even if you take that his voice was a little bit unconventional and that his look was a little bit unconventional, I mean, one of those songs would have had to have done it. And I think maybe it was partly that a label like Enigma, where Game Theory spent most of their career, didn't really have the muscle to do it. And there's still really no excuse for it.
And I agree. There really isn't an excuse for it. But I'm thankful that I was able to get into the band. Lucky to have the chance to spread their music onto those of you who may not have heard them. Just to briefly wrap up the end of the story, the band sort of fell apart on touring behind Two Steps from the Middle Ages. The lineup shifted. Donette Thayer left. She formed a group called Hex with Steve Kibley from the Church that some of you might remember. And in 1989, Miller put together another new version of Game Theory with Michael Cresso from the 3 O'Clock, Joseph Becker, Gil Ray. They did some recording. They did a little touring. They toured through the fall. They went into the studio. These recordings didn't really seem to be going anywhere, I don't think, and didn't seem to have a tremendous amount of focus for Scott. Yet again, he was still writing these incredible songs, and none of these songs came out during his lifetime. Two records with these recordings came out, one in 2017 called Supercalifragile, which I believe Scott was going to use as a title for maybe the next Game Theory project, and then in 2020, Across the Barrier of Sound. And interestingly enough, that was the record, its release about a year ago, that got me into the idea of doing these interviews, Again, it just took a while to put all this together. And I'll very briefly tell you that Scott did form another band called The Loud Family, an excellent band, a topic for another time. Maybe a year from now, we'll get into that. And Scott's life ended rather tragically and far too soon. And you can find out all the information you want about that if you're so inclined. But I wanted to keep this focus on Game Theory. I wanted to keep it positive and just think about the magic that this band is. And I hope there are people out there who get into the band because of this, because I really think they're wonderful and his work deserves to be treasured and to stay around for a long time. So I'm glad that Omnivore has reissued all the original records with tons of extra tracks and really interesting covers that show his influences and how fun Game Theory could be and the great sense of humor and playfulness that was in a lot of these songs and the things they created. And I'd want to leave with the fact that I think, you know, there's a lot of influence that Game Theory left. I certainly think that the shorter songs that Guided by Voices started developing in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, I'm sure Bob Pollard has heard of Game Theory and probably listened to Lolita Nation. I think, as Annie Zaleski pointed out, a band like the Posies is influenced by Game Theory. And they're, you know, listening to their music, I'm sure there are plenty of others, too. And glad to be able to do my tiny, tiny, tiny little part to keep the legacy of Scott Miller alive. And with that, why don't we play out with a little more Game Theory from Two Steps from the Middle Ages?
Patrick, that was great stuff.
Thank you. And
excellent.
I want to say thanks to Brett Milano and Annie Zaleski. I'm kind of embarrassed to say it took this long to get those interviews out there, but
no.
You know, it was right at the beginning of the pandemic, and you know, we really didn't have a plan together, and we were just trying to figure all this, you know, this remote recording out, and and we did. So I want to thank them very much, and hope that folks got something from it and really get excited by the music of Game Theory and the genius that was Scott Miller.
So you mentioned that their stuff has been reissued, mm-hmm. right? And it's is it available on streaming services?
It is, yep. You can find pretty much everything on the major streaming services. All the records have been reissued on vinyl. So, you know, the Scott Parks of the world can go out there if they want to start their game theory collection and get going. And all of the reissues have wonderful liner notes, at least the couple I've gotten, to fill in with my original records. You know, there's a lot to discover there. So definitely go check that out. Omnivore Recordings is the place to go to find all that info.
Is there a certain album where people should start, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listening to, you know, these 2 days, I think probably Big Shot Chronicles. Everything you'll hear is interesting. And Omnivore Recordings is a really interesting reissue label, too. They've reissued a lot more than just the game theory stuff, and also put out new recordings. So go check them out at omnivorerecordings.com.
All right, great stuff. And tomorrow, let's see here. Tomorrow, we have some patron episodes for the rest of the week. So
yes.
This is a very eclectic and interesting week, I think, if you
really is.
Are tuning in for the first time. You stumbled upon just how bizarre this podcast can be, I think.
Yeah. If you're here for the game theory, this is kind of how we roll this week.
Yeah. Then stay for the Lee Hazelwood. So
that's right.
All right. Let's move on then. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
I'm gonna start that again.